Happy grad students are all alike. Every unhappy grad student is unhappy in his own way. Elif Batuman experienced both emotions during her 7 years at Stanford University studying Russian language and literature, and now she's written a collection of essays under the very Dostoevskian title The Possessed, in which she discusses topics ranging from studying Uzbek to exploring the possibility of Tolstoy's having been murdered. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You followed your heart when you followed the Russians, but did you ever consider what giving herself up to passion did to Anna Karenina?
Yeah, in a way that's a cautionary tale that I could have paid more attention to. But on the upside, then, you know, you have this beautiful book, Anna Karenina, which would not exist otherwise.
And one of the first Russian novels you read?
Yes.
That's a good way to start, isn't it? How old were you when you read it?
I was in high school, so I wasn't, you know, in Soviet education, they read these things when they're 12. I was 17, I think.
And what was your mother's reaction when she heard you were reading it?
Oh, she was really happy because it was actually her copy of Anna Karenina that I found in Ankara in her childhood apartment. And her reaction was that now I could tell her what it meant and explain it to her, the secret messages that she might have missed.
Because it was in English, and English was not her first language.
Yes, exactly. It was an English translation. Yeah.
And you were brought up speaking Turkish as well?
Yeah, I didn't grow up quite bilingual. I learned English first. Then I was visiting my grandparents, I think, when I was 3 or 4, and there was a coup, so we couldn't, the airports were all closed. So I was there for 3 or 4 months, and that's when I really learned to speak Turkish.
And what other languages have you picked up along the way?
Well, Spanish in high school, which Don Quixote was actually a big text in my dissertation, and Russian in Russian and French in graduate school.
And what was your original major in college?
Literature.
Uh-huh. But then you switched?
Oh, sorry. Originally it was linguistics, uh-huh. And then I switched to literature along the way.
Although they're linked, obviously.
They're linked not as much as I thought they were at first. I mean, I feel like I went into linguistics thinking that it would explain to me things which, in retrospect, I see are only explained by literature.
And you left school knowing you wanted to be a writer, but you didn't go for the MFA. You didn't go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop or Brooklyn College or any of a number of other respectable programs.
Yeah, I didn't. I had a lot of attitude problems. I knew I wanted to be a writer when I started my undergraduate career, but I had all these ideas that you know, great literature is inspired by life and not by books, and that too much study about craft would be bad for me. And then I also had kind of an attitude problem about not wanting to have to read things by people as ill-informed as myself, like my fellow students at a creative writing program.
But then you wind up analyzing things for magazines like N Plus One. You were asked by the magazine to evaluate the state of the American short story. Isn't that the sort of thing graduate students do?
Yeah, absolutely. That I would say was after my conversion. So when I first went into graduate school, I was thinking that I would just kind of stick around for a year while I wrote a novel. And that plan kind of didn't work out. And then when I went back into graduate school, I kind of got sucked in, and that's the period of time I write about in The Possessed, and that's when I wrote that piece for N Plus One.
You talk about the fact that in Chekhov's famous short story, The Lady with the Lapdog, the lapdog doesn't have a name. Why is that important?
Well, one of the things that I was writing about in the N Plus One piece was that actually when they assigned that piece to me, they wanted something about the current state of American writing, and I objected that I didn't know anything about the current state of American writing. I was in graduate school studying 19th century literature. So they mailed me the best American short stories of 2003 and 2004, which I sat down to read all at once, which is probably not the reading experience one is intended to have. But I was completely overwhelmed by this barrage of proper names that every animal, every, you know, some plants, every single person was given a proper name, which I felt was an attempt to sort of piggyback to a fully formed identity in kind of a disingenuous way.
So you say Americans name more than Russians? My experience in reading Russian literature is that we have the first name, the patronymic, the last name. We have all of those nicknames suddenly without explanation. Alexander is Sasha. Alexei is Alyosha, Ekaterina is Katya, and I don't know when, I'm not sure who I'm reading about.
Well, yeah, that's very traumatic for a lot of readers, but that's really a different problem. So every character having 15 different names is possibly problematic, but it's the thing I was talking about in the American stories is more that every last person who's ever mentioned, you know, in Russian books, there will still be someone who's just, oh, the lackey walked in, and you don't find out who mm-hmm. the lackey is and that he had a headache.
And the dog doesn't have to be named. In America, we definitely would have named it Puffy to make some kind of a point.
We would have, yes.
You came across a study that said Americans tend to enter careers where the job resembles their name. So there's a disproportionate number of dentists who are named Dennis, although I would have thought Dick Cavett would have been a really good name for a dentist.
Yes.
Is there a psychological explanation?
Yeah, the explanation that I read was it was called implicit egotism, and the explanation that was given was that people have baseline good feelings about their own name and that they seek out careers that give them that good feeling.
And you think that's true?
The alternate explanation that I offered in my book was that people want to bring language into agreement with the real world. So if someone has a name, they want their name to seem to be meaningful and to fit in somehow with the facts of the world.
My guest is Elif Batuman. I'm trying to figure out how her name applies to this book, how my name applies to being a talk show host.
It does. I explain in the book how my name applies to the book. It's because Elif, my first name, is the first letter of the Arabic alphabet.
Like Aleph, the
yes,
Hebrew alphabet.
Exactly. So I write about that in the book, is that there's a famous essay by Foucault about Don Quixote where he compares Don Quixote being very long and skinny to being a character who's escaped from the printed page and is out in the world. And Elif is actually drawn as a straight line, and my parents named me that because I was a long and skinny baby. I was born a month early. So I was writing that I very much identified with that description of Don Quixote.
Her book, The Possessed, a similar title to one that Dostoevsky wrote, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them. It's published by FSG. In your introduction, you compare yourself to Hans Castorp in Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain. He went to visit a friend in a sanitarium and wound up staying there for 7 years, and it's unclear whether he had TB like the other people at the sanitarium.
Yeah, it's true. There's something mythical about that 7 years, that Oedipus was washed up on an island for 7 years, that people can somehow get derailed from their life project for this mythical amount of time, I thought was interesting.
And what happened with you? How'd you get derailed for 7 years?
Well, as I said, I initially thought that, you know, graduate school was just a you know, way to pay the rent while I was writing a novel. And instead, I got sucked in, as Hans Castorp was sucked into his time on the Magic Mountain because he fell in love and became obsessed with these people and drawn into these interpersonal relationships. So did I become sucked into the milieu of graduate school and ended up there for 7 years.
Of course, Thomas Mann is not a Russian, but we have a lot of Russians here. Who was the first Russian in your life?
The first Russian in my life that I write about in the book was my violin teacher when I was in high school.
And did he lead to your love for Russian literature?
In a way, yeah. There were various sort of enigmatic experiences that I had with him, one of which... So the first Russian book that I read, actually, the one right before Anna Karenina, was Eugene Onegin. And there's a famous scene where Tatiana has a dream, and she's surrounded by all of these monsters, and then she finds herself at a monster's party, and at the head of the table is Eugene Onegin. So there was a similar situation where I was going to an audition, and my violin teacher had been preparing me for this audition and saying, you know, we don't know who are going to be the judges of this jury. And then when I went there, he was sitting there at the head of the table, and it really freaked me out and made me think of Eugene Onegin.
A lot of the Russian writers, especially of the 20th century, are tragic figures. Mayakovsky, the great poet, Yuri Alyosha, you write about Isaac Babel.
Yes.
How important is he in the history of Russian literature in your estimation?
Babel, I think he's hugely important. In a way, a lot of his followers have been, or the people who followed in his footsteps have been American writers. He was hugely important for Philip Roth, Grace Paley, people like that.
Saul Bellow, I think.
Saul Bellow, of course, yeah. In Russia also, I mean, he changed how the short story was written. I think he was very important, yeah.
And you put together an exhibition for the International Babel Conference?
Yes, I helped curate that exhibit with my professor Gregory Fraden at Stanford.
Are you? I'm always sad that more people don't know him and haven't read his work, even though I think the complete works were made available not so long ago in a couple of volumes.
They were, yeah, in a nice translation. And Professor Fraden actually just did a Norton Critical Edition. Those are really nice editions.
Why was he arrested?
He was arrested for unclear reasons. They accused him of all kinds of different things, and there's a lot of different debate. He was arrested right after the purges, so it was people, you know, he probably thought he had made it through. He was accused of sabotage and collaborating with the French and collaborating with the Austrians. No one really knows why people...
Well, had he written anything that would lead you to think of him as being totally anti-Soviet?
Not on the surface. Red Cavalry, the first famous thing that he wrote, this Red Cavalry cycle, was about his experiences as a propagandist in the Russian Civil War against Poland. And he described a lot of kind of mismanaged campaigns and a lot of bungling and a lot of not very, you know, bad behavior by the Cossacks who are in the army. He described it as, you know, they got these essentially untrained, kind of ignorant Cossacks to fight their war for them, and the Cossacks were actually just, you know, basically repeating the pogroms that they had always been doing under the names of Soviet ideology. So he got a lot of, Babel got a lot of flack after from the, you know, the generals who he worked for.
You write about applying for a fellowship to study the Uzbek language, mm-hmm. not Kazakh, not Russian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Why Uzbeki?
Uzbek, it's a long, complicated story, and I mean, looking back, I kind of feel like it should almost never have happened, which is what, you know, I write about in the book. It had this accidental quality in my life. I was introduced to it by accident. It was the first Central Asian Turkic language, that Soviet, that I learned about by chance when I was studying in Moscow. I had a friend whose sister lived there, and he had a lot of their money, like the bills in the apartment. And I remember just seeing that the numbers are the same in Turkish and in Uzbek, and just seeing that those numbers written in Cyrillic script with these pictures of these, you know, these Soviet style portraits of the, you know, Uzbek national heroes. It was just a strange combination of Turkish and Russian. So you know, Turkish represented my identity for me, and Russian identified was the object of study. So it was like this.
And what did it turn out to be? More Turkish? Samarkand is the big city, the capital.
Tashkent.
Tashkent is?
Yeah, Samarkand. There was a choice, Tashkent or Samarkand. I chose Samarkand because I thought it was more exotic. It sounded more ancient. Tashkent is like the Soviet capital. I interrupted.
No. Well, did it turn out to be a mixture of the two, as the money did?
That was my expectation, that it would sort of reconcile these two entities. And of course, that was very naive of me, because it's its completely own thing. It's its own country. It's its own culture. It was a big surprise.
You write that there are some people who believe Tolstoy was murdered. There's a movie out now, The Last Station. Everything I've heard was that Tolstoy was rather sickly at the end and gotten rather cranky and was arguing with his wife, ran off to the railway station, and then just died at a fairly old age.
Yeah, that's, as far as I know, I'm the only person who has advanced this theory that Tolstoy was murdered, and I really advanced it sort of as a joke. I was applying for grants, and I was going to Tolstoy's house to present a conference paper, but the grants for field research were larger than the grants for presenting a paper. So I was thinking, what kind of field research could I do at Tolstoy's house? And it occurred to me, you know, what if Tolstoy did not die of natural causes but was murdered? And as you say, he was, you know, my advisor's response was exactly like yours. He was 82 years old. He had pneumonia. And I, you know, my response was, that's what would make it a perfect crime.
And you wind up showing up at the Tolstoy estate looking like one of the followers.
Yeah, unfortunately, my suitcase was lost on the way there, and I had actually just finished reporting a story for the New Yorker. I was going there in a big hurry. I was basically wearing pajamas or jogging clothes on the plane, and my suitcase was lost. So I found myself at Yasne Polyana in my jogging suit.
And everybody thought, "Well, she's."
But it was a statement. Yes.
So did the Tolstoy paper work out finally?
It worked out. I mean, there were some people who liked it and some people who didn't necessarily like it, as all papers are.
Now, one of the things that everybody's noticed here is that this is a book about some serious literature, and yet it's very funny. And Roz Chass did the cover,
yes.
Which reveals to us that it's going to be funny. Do you just write funny?
I think one of the things I value most in life is being made to laugh and being entertained. So I'm really happy if I'm able to make people laugh. I love the cover. I'm a huge admirer of Roz Chast.
Well, there are some Russian writers who are pretty funny, like Gogol.
They are.
But Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, The Possessed, it's just not funny.
Okay, yeah, The Possessed is not funny. But I think Tolstoy is very funny, and parts of Dostoevsky are incredibly funny. Actually, what, you know, in college when I was deciding between British, French, and Russian novels to concentrate on, my feeling was that, you know, the British novels were very funny, but they weren't that serious. This is a huge simplification, but the French novels were serious and sad and cynical, but not really all that funny. And the Russians, I thought, had the best mix, that they were funny and sad at the same time.
Elif Batuman will be appearing at McNally Jackson Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. That's at 52 Prince Street. And then she'll be at Book Court in Brooklyn this Friday at 7 o'clock. The book, The Possessed Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.